Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined today by Ken Katkin, a professor of law at Chase Law School. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Hey, thanks, Trey. It's great to be here.
It's always fun having you, Ken. It's always fun to do the shows. Now, we're doing them a little bit closer, and we're doing something a little bit different today. We're starting to try to have an overview for the shows as we go through. And I know Mike started that a week or 2 weeks ago now. And we've got a lot of things. We've got a lot of things on the docket. So here's what we're going to be covering in this week's show. We're going to start by taking a look about Biden on his crime slash gun initiative. We're going to talk about that some. And then we're going to transition. I don't think it's too hard of a transition. I think we're going to make a transition to the New York mayoral race, where we're going to have a chance to talk about both ranked choice voting, because I know that listeners are always very interested in different voting schemes, but also what some pundits are already seeing as a connection between crime and the results and potentially both parties. Then, if I know Ken and I, one of the only things we ever really get heated on is coming up third as we get into the infrastructure bill and everything there. And I think, I mean, we may curse at each other. I don't know. It could happen. I don't think either one of us curse, actually. So that's not going to happen. We're not going to curse at each other. But we're going to get heated, maybe. I don't know. And then if we have time, we're going to tackle two major Supreme Court cases. The first is going to be students' First Amendment rights off campus and how far that extends. And then we'll finish up the show, if there's time, with how antitrust laws impact the NCAA. Now, if we can't get it on today's main show, that just means we're going to have even more for a really exciting bonus show. That bonus show is our supporters-only midweek show. So if we don't get to it, that's where it's going to be. And if you are a supporter, you'll have access to that. But I've also got some special fun news. In addition to our supporters-only midweek show, this week we're also going to have a special, and this is available to all. It's just going to come through our normal channel, an interview episode. So we'll have a Wednesday interview. Yeah, we have an interview. This week I had the pleasure of interviewing Seth David Radwell on his book coming out next week, no less, entitled American Schism. So this week we're going to have our show. We'll have a bonus show as we always do, but we'll also have an extra open to all midweek interview. It's a big week coming up. But before we get into today's show, Ken, we're going to pause here for a word from our sponsors. Well, Ken, crime. Biden and crime. I don't know. It always comes back to this somehow. but we're good. But this week on Wednesday, Biden spoke on guns and crime. Now, why? I think a little bit of context here is useful. For the first time in some time, crime rates, especially murder, have been ticking up. Now, one of the trends of the contemporary age of my lifetime, of your lifetime too, Ken, we're close. We can share a lifetime, I think. Has been a decrease in crime. Beginning in the 1990s and moving forward, crime rates began and have continued to drop steadily. As a matter of fact, from 93 to 19, it dropped 49%. Now, this was a really important empirical trend in political science and specifically the sub-area of political communication, and that's one of my areas, because it allowed us to look at the effects of media. What was really unique about this time was, at the same time as real crime rates were dropping precipitously, media, specifically at the local level, although the national level and other kinds of shows did this too, began to increase its coverage of crime, and specifically violent crime, at nearly the same rate as true crime levels were decreasing. It was a great way to kind of get at, well, is it the thing itself? Is that what indicates how voters are going to vote? Or is part of this or any of this effect connected to communication? It's a cool literature. However, things have begun to change on the empirical side. In major cities, analysts like Jeff Asher are computing that the murder rate in 2021 is 23.5% higher than it was a year ago at the same time. Of course, the key question on policymakers' minds is, what is the cause? Now, on Wednesday, I think Biden made clear that he saw guns as at least one of the major primary issues here. And so his proposal, his five-part proposal, includes cracking down on gun sellers with a new zero-tolerance policy, giving additional support to law enforcement to help with summer crime rates, specifically this summer, investing in community intervention programs, expanding summer employment for young people, and helping incarcerated individuals successfully reenter into the community. So, Ken, there's kind of two things I want to lead us with, I kind of want to point out and highlight. One, while I have been open to discussions on gun control, as a matter of fact, it was dawning on me as I was doing the interview this week that one of the last times I did an interview, Mike did an addendum to the interview when I interviewed the author of Abolish the Second Amendment because he thought I was too sympathetic, right? You know something weird is going on when the left comes in and says, wait a second, Dre, you're too sympathetic to gun control. But I'm a little leery here of the Biden connection that guns are the primary reason that we're seeing an uptick in crime right now from 2019 forward. As a matter of fact, when you look at the rates of guns involved in violent crime, they're up a little bit, but not nearly at the same rate as we're seeing violent crime up or murder rates. So, for example, if you look at somebody who's not even it's not the NRA or anything. If you look at the Gun Violence Archive, violence-related shootings are up at the same time only 4%, so a far lower pace overall than the increase in crime that we're seeing. The second thing I want to kind of put out there for us, Ken, is I'm wondering if Biden isn't setting himself up a little bit here for failure. One of the issues that came from the left, and this is one of the ones where my libertarianness kind of fell on the left, was that back in the day, the kind of the standard procedure for dealing with crime was problematic, and it led to a lot of the systematic race issues that we see in policing. And so what I kind of see here a little bit potentially as we redirect some pandemic funds so that police forces can ramp up, maybe kind of that kind of policy in a 2.0 version. So I'm kind of wondering, what do you think about those two items? And then as we kind of get into more broadly, Biden's proposals on gun and crime.
There was a whole lot in what you said, so I hope I'll address everything. And if I fail to address some of the things you said, just remind me and I'll get back to it.
Of course.
But the I would start by distinguishing, and this is a distinction I think you drew, but I'd really want to highlight it, between policy and politics here. I think there's an enormous disjunction right now between what would be good policy and what would be good politics. I think the politics, I pretty much agree with, I think, your perception that the increase in violent crime over the past year is going to be a big political issue, and it's primarily going to play to the benefit of law and order type Republicans and against Democrats and other advocates of police reform.
There are some Democrats who have taken that position. You know, not to, you know, they're not all. I think sometimes it's easy to kind of group all of Democrats in a kind of a defund the police position. I think there's a little bit of space there, but I agree with you. I don't disagree.
Politically, Republicans are going to be able to paint Democrats as the party of police reform. So even though not all Democrats are actually in favor of police reform, I think it's a political problem for Democrats. It's an issue that plays to the advantage of Republicans. On policy, however, and this is going to be a problem, I think, for serious Democrats. On policy, I don't see that there's any good policy reason to back away from police reform based on this temporary blip in the crime rates. And, you know, I think Democrats are going to have to do it anyhow. I think they're going to actually have to capitulate to some bad policy initiatives for reasons of political survival, which I think is unfortunate. But I think, you know, that's what's going to happen. And let me explain a little more. I think there were a couple of statistical fallacies or in the way you presented the data that I would quibble with a little bit, even though your presentation was accurate. I think it was spun in a certain way. Which is that, you know, when you talked about the number, I think 25% increase, was that the number that you said?
The one is 23.5, yeah.
23.5% increase, yeah. I think what you have to remember here is that that's as measured against a very low baseline, right? So if you, you know, I think we had homicide rates, you know, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago that were below 5 homicides per 100,000 population. So if that goes up from 5 homicides per 100,000 population to 6 homicides per 100,000 population, you know, then, you know, numerically you could say, well, that's a 23% or 25% increase. But remember, any increase is going to look big when you're starting against such a small baseline. We're still only talking about an increase of one homicide out of every 100,000 unit population here. Which is, you know, if you looked at it that way, is statistically much smaller. Similarly, what you said about firearm homicides, I think, you know, the way you presented it downplayed the reality a little bit because the baseline was so large to begin with. Right. So if we're talking about, you know, if you look at all homicides, I'm looking at 2018 numbers right now, which are, you know, a good year. So in 2018, when homicides were a little bit less than now, there were 19,141 homicides in the country, and 14,414 of them were firearm homicides. So 75%, you know, a fairly high percentage are firearm homicides. And so, you know, if you say, well, that only went up by 4%, still, that's a lot more firearm homicides because it was a high percentage to begin with.
Now, so there's truth. And you're right. When you have to put those kinds of mean statistics into, you know, level changes. And you're right, you got to talk about your base rate and what that change means. My implication there wasn't about the absolute. So I'm not trying to say one number, you know, this percentage of base rate is different from this percentage. Rather, what I'm trying to get at is, I mean, again, we're doing it in a podcast kind of way, but my hypothesis would be is that the real base rate changes ought to be significant in the sense that of that new amount coming in, whatever that up is from 2020, in this case, you're looking from 2018 and now we're talking about 2021.
Yeah.
If guns were the cause of that, you would assume that most of that change, that delta, would be gun, right? In other words, the guns are the ones that explains the change from whatever that baseline is to whatever this new data point is. What I was only trying to get at was I don't think we've established kind of a causality. Whatever the problem of guns is, I'm willing to have that conversation, it doesn't appear that its presence or absence as a variable is the thing that explains that uptick. And again, and I think you're right in pointing out when it's low, those numbers are going to be higher. But however you want to think about that uptick, I don't think it's explained by the presence of guns any more than guns explained its relatively low rate in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say I disagree with you on that, but I will say I think it's a little more uncertain than you're saying. I would just say I don't know, you know, rather than saying, you know, you're right or you're wrong, because the way I'm trying to think about this is, you know, let's say, you know, it's a fact that 75% of all homicides are gun homicides. And so if the homicide rate increases a lot, then 75% of all the new homicides would be gun homicides. And what you're hypothesizing is that, well, that doesn't have anything to do with more availability of guns. But I would just say, I don't know. I mean, we know that most of these new homicides are being committed with guns, even if the rate of gun homicides hasn't changed much. So I just think that makes it cloudy to say, well, you know, if we have a lot more homicides and 3/4 of all of them are being committed with guns, just like 3/4 of all the old homicides were being committed with guns, I wouldn't rule out the idea that that they've been facilitated by greater ability of guns, although I wouldn't say the case is proved either.
Well, here and maybe I'm going to take, you know, sometimes, you know, we'll get on things. But as a scientist, if you have a jump in data, right? So if you're looking at a time series and you're saying, okay, I have these new data points and I'm trying to understand what changes me from here to this new norm. Now, again, the other thing that we have to decide here, and I would want to caution, and I think this is part of what you get it to at the politics and the policy, is that the politics of this says, oh, we have definitively a new rate. I mean, it very well could be that what we're seeing is an outlier on, or noise, effectively, noise in a larger trend. And so, you know, for those of us who are just talking about this in policy terms, I'm not even quite willing to say, hey, I think found, you know, we've had a structural change and therefore it is. But assuming we have had a structural change, I think your point there to say, well, if it's 75 and then it's 75, you know, we can't rule it out. I mean, you can't generally rule many things out on that kind of scientific. But if I, as a scientist looking at the data, I'm not going to argue that we've had a structural shift to a time series on a variable that has existed through the whole time series if I don't see anything, any movement in the explanatory power of that. And you should see that at least a little bit in the mean, in that. So if something was unique about guns, and again, that's there why I think that I'm having problem with Biden already saying, well, hey, listen, we got this crack. We do this gun thing. We're going to fix this. We're going to fix this crime problem.
I completely agree with you on Biden. That's entirely about politics and not about policy. But what I would say just, and then I'll stop talking about how to look at data, but I think,
no, this, you know, is fun. We don't do that often. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All I would say is I think these questions are more answerable through research that I haven't seen yet, which would look at compare localities against other localities, because we're talking about national numbers here. But there's places where the gun laws have actually been liberalized over the past few years. And there's places where the gun laws were already very, very lenient and haven't really changed. And I think I haven't seen this work, but it seems to me it could be done if you wanted to really tease out, well, what's the impact of gun regulation on changes in crime rates? You know, compare the places where gun regulation has, in fact, been relaxed and weakened over the past few years with places where it hasn't been relaxed and weakened over the past few years.
Compare
and see if you get differences in the change in crime rates. And you know, I'm thinking particularly of Chicago. I mean, I haven't seen Chicago compared with any place else. But, you know, Chicago is one of the cities that's doing the worst right now. It's had a massive increase in gun crime. And of course, it is the city where the U.S. Supreme Court struck down all their gun control laws. So, you know, I'd have to see that compared with other places, but I'm not going to draw conclusions just from that anecdotal evidence. But it seems to me like that at least suggests we could look into the hypothesis that places where it's become easier to get guns recently are really possibly potentially, and this has to be verified, you know, driving some of this increase. So I think that's possible. On the other hand,
That is possible. And just to kind of point out for listeners, I'm just going to geek for 2 seconds for those who might want to know. What you've set up there is a naturalized experiment, right? So one way to try to get at the question we're looking at is to say, well, you can compare these different locations, right? So it, generally in the social sciences, you know, we can't put people into different countries and see what the outcomes are. Instead, we've got to find these naturalized experiments and then do it. And that's what you're suggesting. The other one, the one that I was mentioning, you know, the other way to do it at the national level is you can use what's called time series analysis, where you're looking at aggregate data over time, and you can then attempt to see if different changes over time can explain a structural change in data over time. And that's a second way that social scientists can get at these broad questions. I don't think either one of those are wrong. And as a matter of fact, that would be a great way to do it. I mean, obviously, nobody's done data on 2021. It takes longer than that to make it happen. But I agree with you. That would certainly be a very valid naturalized experiment.
And let me come back around to the part where I completely did agree with you. So I'll just highlight that. I think there's the changes in crime that we saw in 2020 and they've continued a bit into 2021. It just seems so probable to me that this is what you called noise because of the pandemic. because we had a whole lot of people thrown out of work, you know, with nothing to do, hanging around all the time. We had a lot of people thrown into kind of desperate economic circumstances. You know, some of the populations that were most affected by this were young men, and particularly young men without careers or without college educations. They're put in a much more desperate circumstance than they'd been living in before. And that kind of thing is a typical driver of crime. So it seems to me that if you see a change in certain kinds of violent crime during a pandemic, it seems natural to hypothesize that may have been actually caused by the social dysfunction associated with the pandemic more than other things. And so I tend to think it's going to blow over as the economy reopens, just naturally. Although we're never really going to get a clean way to look at that, because there's going to be a lot of policy responses. So we're not going to find out if it would just blow over without new policy responses.
And that's always difficult. You know, you don't get the null in these kinds of situations always, which is difficult as a social science. So I want to ask kind of one last little thing in here, and I had hinted at it, but I want to be explicit. You know, this upcoming week, we're in the midst of thinking about and kind of finding the end to some of the cases on police interactions that had led to the Black Lives Matter protests. And one of the things that I worry about, and I wonder if you're in this camp too, is by kind of, are we resetting that clock again? I mean, it seems like every time that there is some positive move forward in thinking about, and you had mentioned just briefly kind of the police reform side of it, every time we make some positive movement in that direction, as soon as we have anything that resembles either the perception of crime or in this case, the actual uptick in crime, that all just whomp, and that's just gone. And again, here, this is kind of particularly troublesome, because this is one of the things I think Biden was promising on, was that he was not going to repeat the mistake. I mean, he called it a mistake that he had taken in the past. And this seems like a repeat of that mistake. I mean, is that just me being too critical of Biden? Or do you agree that this is, in fact, a setback for police reform as it concerns systematic racism, and Biden kind of walking back his position on saying that he was wrong?
I think it's too early to say, because I think the initiatives that he announced, you know, the devil's going to be in the details of how they're implemented. So, for instance, Biden announced that he's freeing up $350 billion of the funds that had already been allocated for state and local governments as part of the COVID relief funds. And he says that money can be used now to shore up police departments and to support community-based anti-violence groups. So, you know, one way of looking at this is, well, this is money's all just going to be used to hire more police who are going to have fraught interactions with communities. And that would be a backsliding, as you're talking about.
Be for building their arsenal.
yeah, right, which would be terrible. But I think another way to look at it, by him saying to shore up police departments and to support community-based anti-violence groups, is that he's kind of pursuing a two-track strategy here, where, you know, if the defund the police movement has been about taking away money from police forces and giving it to alternative institutions that can deal with different kinds of social problems, you know, deal with homeless people or with, you know, more social work type stuff, basically. I think by freeing up this much money, you know, the money could be going into that stuff. And then that would, you know, it wouldn't defund the police. The police would still have as much money as they always had. But it would be giving money to other state and local government institutions that could do some of the frontline work that police wouldn't have to do anymore, which would be, you know, some of the most, that would ameliorate some of the most fraught interactions between police and communities. And so that could advance some of the goals of the police reform movement, by funding shoring up institutions other than police without actually taking any money away from police. So I think that would be not necessarily bad. I think we haven't seen how things are going to go. The other parts of the initiative, I think, don't really go against the goals of police reform, because he did things like he directed the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms to revoke the licenses of gun dealers the very first time they violate
new
federal
zero
law
policy
on background checks. Right. No. So doing something like that, like saying gun dealers better do their background checks or they're going to immediately lose their licenses. You know, that is a nod towards gun control regulation, but that's not at all in any kind of opposition to the goals of the police reform movement. So I think, you know, there, I think it just, you know, some of the initiatives that he has announced, we'll have to see how they play out. But I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that this is really going to be about providing arsenals to police, although it could be, and I'd be disappointed if it is.
That's going to be something we'll have to kind of continue to look at, and we'll have to continue to take a look at how that data comes out, and we'll have to have more conversations about that. What I want to turn to next, Ken, is the New York mayoral race and all of the... Every time we ask for listener questions, we always get things on different kind of voting systems. So the New York mayoral race is a really great one for that. But before we get into it, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsors. So, Ken, as we come back from the break, what we want to get back into is the New York mayoral race. And as a matter of fact, it's being tallied as we speak. But according to the Wall Street Journal, Eric Adams is holding the strongest lead with 31% of the nearly 800,000 votes. Now, the mayoral race is worth talking about in part because of the election method. It's the first time they're using ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting is a system in which you vote for more than one individual on the ballot. As a matter of fact, out of the 13 candidates, New Yorkers had the opportunity to vote for five. Now, they're not just voting for five equally, they're actually ranking those one through five. And so in this case, what ends up happening is that those who don't reach a certain threshold get thrown out, and therefore those ballots then move down to choice number two or choice number three. What is unique about Adams' lead currently, of course, was he had not gotten a lot of that number one spot. As a matter of fact, Adams seemed primarily be getting a lot of number two and a three. We're not officially going to know a winner or be declared a winner until July 12, because we still have to do the absentee ballots. And as we get into the weekend, not all of the ranked choice voting math is finished yet. Now, on the Republican side, Curtis Sliwa, founder of the crime prevention group Guardian Angels, won with an outstanding 69% of the votes. Now, I mention that because one of the pundit takeaways right now, Ken, is that maybe the reason that Adams is as high as he was and the Republican wins is because of their stance on crime. As a matter of fact, Adams was early in his promises on this. And to link back into what we were talking about with Biden, one of the things that Adams promised at the outset of the campaign is that he's going to bring back an anti-crime unit in New York that was disbanded after the Black Lives Matter protests. So I kind of wonder, there's two kind of tracks here. One is this ranked choice voting, and the other is the beginning of trying to untangle the possibility that crime is already playing a role in not only the Republican side of it, as you had mentioned in the Biden, but perhaps even in Democratic primaries. So thoughts about the New York mayoral race?
Yeah, I mean, the New York mayoral race, Adams did run, as you say, in opposition to the other Democratic candidates who all to one degree or another, you know, some to a small extent, some to a great extent, were to the left of him on police reform issues. Adams also got support from communities on issues that had nothing to do with that. You know, he had the best links to organized labor, which supported him, you know, on their issues, which were not really crime issues. He was the one African-American candidate, and he had deep roots in New York's African-American communities and got a lot of support from those communities. And perhaps you could say, well, that's also those are the communities that are most concerned about crime. But I don't know that I'd say it was entirely about that. And finally, I'd point out that, this was a multi-candidate race and Adams only got about 31% of the vote. So, you know, a lot of the dynamics of why he's going to end up probably being the winner, although that won't be sure for a couple weeks, is, you know, related to the fact that there were so many candidates and someone could win with only 31% of the vote. But still, you know, that means that nearly 70% of the voters didn't vote based on his strong anti-crime stance. So I think there's a lot of uniqueness to why Adams is probably going to be the next mayor of New York, although, again, it's not certain yet. I would say it is certain that Sliwa is not going to be the next mayor of New York. So which also tells you something, because after all, even though New York's a very Democratic city, you know, Giuliani was able to win as a Republican there in the 90s, really almost entirely based on crime, you know, in a city that was very Democratic. So if New Yorkers were as concerned about crime now as they were 30 years ago, then we wouldn't be laughing off the idea that Sliwa could win any more than people laughed off the idea then that Giuliani could win. The other data point, you didn't mention this, but I'll bring it in, that I think is somewhat refutes the thesis that crime has already become dispositive in urban mayoral races, at least, is that in Buffalo, New York, which actually has seen very much more significant increases in violent crime than New York City has, the year-over-year increase in Buffalo was more than 100% from 2019 to 2020. So, you know, very, very dramatic increase in violent crime there. And in the Buffalo, New York primary, there was a really enormous and unpredicted upset where an avowedly socialist candidate who's very much part of the Black Lives Matter movement and who in part was initiated into politics through that movement and a serious advocate of police reform managed to dump a relatively popular four-term incumbent Democrat by 7 points in this primary. So I think we have to, you know, look at the way political winds are blowing in New York, at least in connection with the Buffalo race as well as the New York City race.
No, and my bringing that up, you're right in the sense that I think often it is easy to want to take elections down to a couple of issues. And that's one of the ways, obviously, we talk rationally about elections. But of course, underpinning elections is oftentimes far more structural reasons for winning and losing than particular issues. And, you know, I think sometimes that's hard for, I don't know if it's hard for you, it's sometimes difficult. I mean, I recognize that intellectually as a scholar. I recognize the data on that front. But it is always a little frustrating to have to think, well, issues, they don't matter. But even if issues were the primary, I think you're right. I don't think we can immediately draw an entire choice to it. But I do think the fact that you have an African-American who in New York who is likely going to be the winner is on the, as you had might have put it earlier for the Biden, on the politics side, going to be it's going to be a vignetta of a larger of a potential narrative that's going to come as we come into 2022. And I think part of that will also depend on what actually happens with crime rates as we move into 2022. But anything about the ranked choice voting? I mean, we oftentimes talk about these different kinds of systems. Did you like that we had this kind of system? Again, it's impacting Democrats, so I'd really like to get your take on, or because the way you even he only got 31%, so maybe you were against it. I was curious.
Oh, no, I'm for it. I'm for ranked choice voting. I mean, it's a little bit, you have to have some patience because it does mean we're not really going to know if he won for probably another 2 or 3 weeks. And it could even be looked at and said, well, in both Buffalo and in New York City, the candidate who got the most votes on election day as people's first choice is probably still going to be the winner in both cities at the end of the ranked choice counts. But nonetheless, I'm totally for it. I think ranked choice voting is a great way that third parties can exist within our two-party system, which I'm more or less in favor of. And I think it's also a great way that candidates within parties can present, the different range of views within their parties directly to the voters. Because without it, there's such a tremendous pull to the center. But with it, candidates can, voters can express that they have policy preferences that are farther away from the center, while still not, sort of wasting their votes to cast that way. So whereas it, without ranked choice voting, essentially any vote for candidates that are not, adhering to the center or not highly electable would kind of be a self-destructive kind of way to vote. So I'm for it in terms of what it produces, but it's a little bit, I don't know that this particular election is a great case example of the virtues of ranked choice voting, because I don't think it's going to change the outcomes in these races, and it is introducing a few weeks of a delay to finding out what those outcomes really are.
One of the things that in American social and cultural life that is weird to me is this idea that everything has to be instantaneous. And you were talking about it, and I thought how kind of terrible it is that the fact that it's going to take a week or maybe 2 weeks to know who who's going to win is going to be the reason why we have or not have a particular voting system. Yeah, you know? Right. that we have to talk. And you're right, we do. I mean, that's something we have to talk about. But it's a little bit hard. Well, this one is faster. And true. But I agree with you in that, ranked choice, it's kind of that median ground as electoral systems go between proportional representation, where you're going to get, you can get a lot of different kinds of parties and voices, but here you're still ending up usually with two major parties, but you're getting, as you put it, a little bit more spectral distance within the parties that you don't get when you have just simple first past the post in single member district. That's absolutely true. Now, Ken, I think we should move forward to the thing that might get us, heated. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to try to be heated. Who knows? Well, we need to talk a little bit about the infrastructure bill I don't know. It's the bipartisan bill that isn't. It might be the way you might want to put that. I don't know. Yeah. But before we get into that, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsors. So, Ken, the infrastructure bill. I set this up by kind of calling it the infrastructure bill that isn't. Maybe I'm already kind of playing my hand on this one. A lot of pundits are calling this a breakthrough, and I'm kind of with the Wall Street Journal. I'm calling it just a bunch of rhetorical BS. 21 senators, Republicans and Democrats, announced a compromise on Thursday for the largest ever in history transportation package, clocking in at $1.2 trillion. Now, we already know that we have some differences over, the spending side. I'm just going to kind of put that aside for a minute so we can talk more about the infrastructure bill itself. What makes this a compromise is that's totally on physical infrastructure, which is what Republican senators and Republicans in general really wanted to focus on. Whereas Democrats wanted to think more expansively about what infrastructure could be, kind of to that social capital side. Again, so it's, roads versus roads plus might be one way of thinking about that. Now, that might sound like a huge breakthrough, that something's coming through, that both sides are on board, but they're not really. As a matter of fact, at the end of the press conference, Biden says that if he doesn't also get everything else that he wants, then he's not signing it. As a matter of fact, in his words, if they don't both come, I'm not signing it. Real simple. As a matter of fact, he would go on just 30 minutes later to say, quote, what we agreed on today is what we could agree on, the physical infrastructure. There's no agreement on the rest, end quote. Similarly, Speaker Pelosi won't even bring it up in the House unless it has everything else. So, Ken, here's my question. After all of this hand-wringing, all of this, let's get together on something, what is actually the ever-loving point? Biden coming out saying that he's somehow reached a compromise is a lie. That's not a compromise. To say we have a compromise, but I won't sign it unless I get everything else I want, that's not a compromise. Why is anybody reporting this? What does this matter? The Wall Street Journal and a few other outlets called it an instant double cross. And I have to say, I agree. Tell me I'm wrong and why, Ken. I know you disagree.
Yeah, well, actually, so you built this at the beginning of the show by saying we were going to disagree on this point, but we don't disagree on this point.
Oh, we don't.
Yeah. So there's no This is a it's completely phony. I will just say that I said that 2 weeks ago. You know, when you and I talked 2 weeks ago, I said then, and I'll stand by it now. There is no bipartisan compromise. The only thing that's going to happen is either that all the Democrats are going to get on board and pass the $4 trillion on reconciliation, or McConnell is going to succeed in blocking everything.
He's not blocking everything, though. They can get the infrastructure through. So, I mean, they can do that now. I mean, now who's blocking it is Biden and Pelosi. So if they can't get everything, then you can't say that McConnell is blocking everything. He's blocking half of it.
No, I don't think there would be. I know you said there's 21 votes here, but I don't believe that's the case, because most of the Republicans in that group have actually said that they will not vote even for this bill if the other bill comes through reconciliation. And yet all of the Democrats in this group have always said, well, the other bill could still come from through reconciliation. So there never was an agreement. And really, this is that performative aspect of we talked about this at great length two weeks ago.
Yes.
None of this was ever about the Republicans. It's all about Manchin and Sinema. I can't predict what Manchin and Sinema are going to do. But from day one, none of this was ever about the Republicans, and there was never going to be any Republican votes for any of this, and there won't be. It's just a question of how far Manchin and Sinema need to go, and really Manchin more than Sinema, I think, because I think Sinema will follow along whatever Manchin does. How far he needs to go to demonstrate that he's gone to the mat for bipartisanship. I still extend great hope that more likely than not, he's going to vote for the $4 trillion complete bill on reconciliation. And I think it's critically important that the parliamentarian said that all that can be done on reconciliation. So Manchin's promise not to change the filibuster rule, he would be able to adhere to that promise and still vote for all $4 trillion in spending, which is consistent with the current filibuster rule, including the reconciliation exceptions to that rule, to do that. And I think he's just playing this out. And as I don't want to repeat myself, but as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I think it's taking the Dems all this time even to just get the bill written and agreed to amongst themselves, so that part of what we're seeing is some public theater while the Democrats are actually hashing out the bill. But I think 100% of the outcome is going to turn on whether the Democrats can get Manchin and Sinema on board and pass a big bill on reconciliation. But I see zero chance that bipartisan compromise bill, as it's called, can actually get.
Of course it can't, because two of the principal negotiators told us 30 minutes afterwards that it can't. That's part of the problem. But now here's the thing: that 2 weeks ago, we did talk about Manchin. We talked about the political theater, and on that front, I think we were in agreement. Here's where I have a slight, maybe this is more of a politics disagreement. I think that Biden doing it this way makes him look like an ever-loving fool. He loses. He loses all of it here. And he loses it because he now is the one who owns things if it doesn't come forward, because he's the guy who says, I agree, but I don't. And so now he and Pelosi are the ones who own this. Now, had they never come out and said, we've struck this deal that we don't intend to really agree on, then I think that the political theater works in the favor of pushing pressure on Manchin, and it works in the favor of Democrats. But by doing it this way, they look like sleazeballs. There is no positive spin on coming out and with Republicans and saying we have this. I mean, I can see where Republicans get a win for this. So kudos to those guys for getting this, because this looks awesome if you're a Republican. But it makes Biden look like a jerk. I mean, help me on that one. That's the part, I guess, I really don't understand. So when you talk about this political theater, I get you want to put pressure on Manchin, but this seems like you're costing yourself an awful lot of political theater points, especially here in just a few months as you start ramping up. I mean, talk about the ad. I agree to bipartisanship, but I won't sign it. Like my 8-year-old can write that ad.
Yeah. Okay. Let me start with Pelosi before I get to Biden. I think it was absolutely necessary for Pelosi to say what she said. I agree with you. There's different ways of thinking about what Biden's statements, but the thing about Pelosi is that there's a lot of political risk that you may not be acknowledging here to dispiriting Democrats, right? That almost all Democrats want to see the Dems doing everything they can to pass the entire bill. The idea that that the Dems might just capitulate to this to the basically the Mitt Romney group or the Rob Portman group here of Republican senators would be incredibly demoralizing to Democrats who have majorities in the House, sort of in the Senate, and have the White House, and who want to see a big bill passed. So I think that you can't discount that the almost all Democrats, really pretty much every Democrat in the House and every Democrat in the Senate, except for Manchin and Sinema, and almost all Democratic voters who are a majority of the public who put all those people in office, want to see something much bigger than this bipartisan compromise bill. So I think the Dems, both from the standpoint of politically shoring up their own base and also from the standpoint substantively of maximizing the pressure on Manchin and Sinema to actually go along with the bigger bill, they needed to signal this somehow. And so I'm fully on board with what Pelosi signaled, not only as a signaling method, but as an actual strategy. Like, I think it would be better to risk passing nothing than to pass something that's not much better than nothing from a Democratic perspective. The other question you raise is about Biden and whether Biden should also have said that, or whether he should have just left that messaging to Pelosi, who could do that messaging and who has the ability to carry out that threat, so that Biden would never even he didn't have to make a veto threat, because if she never takes it up in the House, he's never going to have anything on his desk that he'll have to veto or not veto. There, I think there's two ways of looking at it. I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but I will say the possible counter argument, and I can't really tell which one is true, would be that he will get much bigger political rewards if the $4 trillion bill actually passes, because it will be hugely popular with about 70 or 75% of voters, including quite a lot of Republicans, if it actually passes. And that will wash away, within the next couple of years, whatever political turmoil there was about the process for getting it passed. And so he's got to take a risk, right? He's got to, okay, so he could take a short-term hit by looking like he's claiming to be bipartisan, but while actually being partisan, as you say. But that the short-term hit from that would be if he actually succeeds in getting the $4 trillion bill through on reconciliation, the political rewards of that could be very much larger than the political hit from looking like he was too partisan.
Well, we're going to have to kind of see how that plays out as we move forward into 2022, I guess, Ken. And I think additionally, the other side of this, we're not going to touch on it right here. I think we'll do that in a future show in July when we talk about some more economic stuff is the economic side of spending that much. But we'll pause on that now, because we're going to move forward and we're going to talk a little bit about two, again, if we have time for both of these Supreme Court cases. And we want to start with students' speech rights, and specifically students' speech rights off campus. But before we get to that, Ken, we're going to break for just a moment for our sponsors. One of the other big items, and we had actually already touched on this story earlier. I believe it was in a bonus show. I'm not positive. It could have been on the main show. I didn't actually go back and look, but I know we talked about it. It was in that part of my notes. Was about a case that had been working its way through the court system about a profane social media post and the suspension of a cheerleader from a junior varsity team. Now, the case has now made it all the way to the Supreme Court in this past week. The Supreme Court, in an 8-1 decision, overturned a school's control of off-campus activity. So just a really brief refresher on this. A cheerleader had not made the varsity, and she thought she was kind of owed that. She went off campus with a friend. She was at an ice cream place, and they take a Snapchat, and they're flipping the camera, the bird. And the caption is, cheerleading, F softball, F all kinds of things. She was also on the softball team. And of course, this kind of stuff is not as ethereal as students think. As a matter of fact, almost every student, a lot of parents received this as well. And so she was suspended from the cheerleading squad for a year. Now, you know, long story short, she actually would make it on the varsity when she came back from her suspension, but it still makes it through the court because, you know, mootness only sometimes matters, as we've talked about in court cases. Now, what is I found different about this case, but I'm not surprised by, because we've talked about this before, is that in the 8-1 decision, although they rule in favor of the speech, they in no way create a new rule about when can schools regulate off campus and what could or could not be off limits. Although Breyer writes, thus we do not now set forth a broad, highly general First Amendment rule stating just what counts as off campus speech and whether or how ordinary First Amendment stands or, standards must give way off campus, end quote. But he goes on that you have to allow for this kind of vulgarity because you've got to protect vulgarity if you want to protect true speech, which I would actually agree with. The one dissenter is actually Justice Thomas, who argued that by not setting that standard, all that the court had done was make both student and school districts' lives needlessly complicated. As a matter of fact, Thomas writes, quote, the court's foundation is untethered from anything stable, and courts and schools will almost certainly be at a loss as to what exactly the court's opinion today means. So what did you think about this case? And I couldn't help but thinking about our conversation a couple of weeks ago about a case coming up on gun control where I argued, I don't think the court's going to be issuing kind of broad edicts on these kinds of items. And here we are on free speech, and they just went as narrow as humanly possible. So what do you think about all this, Ken?
Yeah, I like your emphasis on the narrowness of the opinion, because I really think this case says more about the Roberts Court than about the First Amendment or the rights of high school students. Roberts right now seems like he's on a campaign or even a mission to tamp down the public perception of the U.S. Supreme Court as a politicized institution. And he seems to be really exerting all the pressure that he possibly can on his fellow justices to not have votes that break down on partisan lines all the time. And in order to accomplish that, and he has been accomplishing that, what it means is having opinions that don't say very much, because the more the opinions say, the more there's going to probably be those partisan disagreements. But the more they agree to leave things unsaid and unresolved, the more they're able to get more consensus on narrow grounds. And in that sense, you know, on the First Amendment issues here, I agree with the way you characterize it. This case doesn't resolve much. It doesn't do much, and it doesn't change the law much. Probably the most significant First Amendment result from it that I could see is that it is the first time since 1969 that students have won a First Amendment case at the Supreme Court against their schools. So they're in 1969 in the Tinker case, mm-hmm. Students got the First Amendment right to wear black armbands in school to protest the Vietnam War. Since 1969, there have been three subsequent Supreme Court cases and many circuit court cases where schools have always won in every case. And so student speech has not claimed another victory until this week's decision in the Brandy Levy case. And so I think that's a positive development. But on the other hand, what the school was doing here was going very far beyond what any school had ever done before in, you know, really trying to regulate speech that had no plausible connection to, it wasn't in the school, it wasn't as part of a school program, it wasn't publicized to anybody but a small group of friends this is a student who sent a WhatsApp or a Snapchat or something to a couple of her friends on a Saturday night. And so that went so far beyond past public school efforts to regulate student speech that I think if any line was ever going to be drawn, you know, on where the school has jurisdiction to discipline their students, you know, it would have to be here. And pointedly, the Breyer majority opinion made a big point of saying that it wasn't deciding the question of whether this means that as long as students are off campus, not in school, and speaking in a way that isn't part of a school program, that they're free of school discipline. It might have been nice, I think, for the court to make that clear, that private speech of students uttered outside of school and not in connection with a school program is not the business of school authorities. But the majority opinion made a point of saying, we're not saying that. So so I think this doesn't really resolve all that much.
No, you know, the only bit I have to add here is that one of the worries I see in the case, even as narrow as it is not even an attempt of thinking about this regulation of off-campus behavior. You know, as you point out, the last time, it was the 60s when we were talking about a case, and on campus, an era where off-campus activity was very much delineated from on-campus activity. And one of the potential problems here by not setting that is you are suggesting, although you're right, it's a victory for a student for the first time, they are clearly, though, saying that there are kinds of off-campus speech that could be regulated. And I will say from my point of view, that's unless you're just talking about somebody as they're logged into their computer into a session or something where I can understand that's kind of a quasi on campus, I don't really understand in what senses a school would have any kind of interest in the regulation of off-campus speech that doesn't in some way directly be digitally touching. In other words, you are live with your, you know, in some kind of classroom setting. And I'm a little worried that seems like a definitive line that ought to be drawn.
Yeah, well, I'm 100%. I'm on your side on that. I'm 100% in agreement with you, and I'm disappointed that the court didn't do that. You know, so what Breyer said in response to that, where he pointedly disagreed with the position that you and I are sharing.
Yes, very much so.
He said that the schools have part of their teaching mission to teach students is to teach them certain kinds of things about what constitutes acceptable behavior. And also he said that certain kinds of speech, even in a purely private capacity, could affect other students or could affect teachers. So he gave some examples like if students are off campus and using social media to harass other students in their school, then in his view, that affects the ability of the student who's being harassed to be able to get educated in school. And for that reason, the school would have authority to regulate that kind of student speech, even though it's totally off campus and using non-school related platforms. And I think that's a bad slippery slope. I don't like to see the court getting into that, empowering school authorities that way. He pointedly did reverse the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which had also ruled in favor of the student, ruled on the stronger and clearer grounds that you articulated, Trey, and said that if this isn't neither speech in school nor speech using some kind of school platform, then the schools just can't regulate it. But Breyer said the schools can still regulate some such speech if some such speech is affecting the school or affecting other students in the school or affecting teachers in the school in some way that impairs the school's ability to fully carry out its mission or that impairs the ability of other students in the school to enjoy their experience as students in the school. So it is a very unclear line. Now, I agree with Thomas's dissent to the extent that he points out that this is a very unclear line. However, in more important respects, I disagree with Thomas's dissent because his remedy for saying, you know, the Breyer's creating
just to make it broader.
Line.
He wants to go much further off campus.
To make it broader, yeah, let's let the school just regulate all this speech and not try to draw these blurry lines and not give the students any rights at all. So, I don't agree with that, but I do agree with his diagnosis, but not his prescription, I guess.
And, you know, and this is an area, and, you know, we could have a whole conversation about this. So I'm not trying to take this on as an entire go. But this, I think, is one of the kinds of problems you encounter when you're having this kind of public education. Because I understand, you know, as an educator, I'm a professor. And one of the things that we try to do at Oklahoma Christian University, and one of the reasons I signed on to this kind of experience, was a whole person development. And that includes thinking about a person's morality and our actions and how we live in community. But what I think makes the problem when you're doing it on the side when you have a government school is everybody here is here voluntarily, right? So you're signing into these kinds of specific rules. And in the Breyer kind of take, as you, I think, rightfully pointed out, suggests that there is one that can kind of be imposed. And while I certainly have a morality and I want to share and help students move towards in that direction, I don't want to enforce that. I mean, it's voluntary, right? It's not one, I don't want to go out into the world and say, do this, but rather I want to help those who want to do it. And I think that's one of the advantages of thinking about education a little differently. But I know it's a bigger thought. There's a lot of thoughts there. And we have one last story that so I think we can get to everything if we handle this one, Ken. Our last story is another Supreme Court case that occurred on Monday, and that's where the Supreme Court shot down the NCAA. And this decision is unanimous. Now, the crux of the NCAA's argument has been that it can effectively bypass antitrust laws because it needs to preserve the good of amateurism in college sports. You know, never mind that, you know, Duke and UK make tons and tons of money. It's really about preserving amateurism. Now, for student athletes, I think it's worth saying, again, we both come from different schools. The vast majority of student athletes are, of course, amateur. They don't make money for their institutions. Our sports don't make money at Oklahoma Christian University. We do it for different reasons. NKU, I don't know if they make money or not, Ken. I can't imagine they're making much money if they're making money.
They lose more than $10 million a year on sports at NKU.
That's what I kind of figured, right? But I didn't want to just throw that out without actually knowing. I hadn't looked it up. But there are a few schools at the top, and that's what this is really about, the schools at the top. And these athletes are bringing in millions and millions of dollars, but they can't get anything in return. So in this case, what's happened is the court argued that the case wasn't about total compensation, but it's about some kinds of educational benefits. And effectively, the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Gorsuch, argues that colleges don't just get de facto immunity from the Sherman Act. A heads up again, the Sherman Act is the primary law that bans anti-competitive practices. He says, look, you don't get to just say, hey, we get immunity from the Sherman Act because you're doing this so-called good of preserving amateurism. And so as a result, colleges can now compete with additional educational compensation, including one of the ones that got a lot of attention was some payouts for good grades, but it includes other things like laptops and materials or special internships or trips, that kind of stuff. Now, the court is effectively saying that tradition alone can't justify the NCAA's decision to build a massive money-making enterprise on the back of student athletes. That's in the words of Kavanaugh. He would go on to say that, quote, nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate, end quote. So what did you think about then? This has been everybody's been talking about this in the sports world. What do you think about this on the legal side, Ken?
Yeah, I think it's a correct application of the antitrust law. I did enjoy reading Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion. It's interesting because as you pointed out, what was at issue in the case was, I would say, very fairly minor, almost trivial premiums that some of these colleges wanted to give to the student athletes. Because under NCAA rules, the colleges were already allowed to give tuition, room, board, book allowances, special tutoring. And so the only restrictions that were really at issue here, as you pointed out, were, you know, could that be supplemented to a very small degree by some things like musical instruments or scientific equipment or payouts for good grades or study abroad trips. What wasn't even challenged in this case was the restriction on not paying salaries. Now, this does seem to lay some groundwork for that. And it seems like the reasoning of this case would support the idea that the NCAA rule that prohibits salaries from being paid to student athletes is similarly vulnerable. And I think it should be. I think that as a matter of antitrust law, there's no real basis for thinking that the Sherman Act shouldn't apply to intercollegiate sports. I guess my only concern about it, which is totally non-legal, is that I think, you know, some of the effect of this is going to be negative with respect to higher ed at most schools, because even though I completely agree with what I take it is, you know, substantial public opinion that when you're looking at schools like University of Kentucky or Ohio State, you know, that make a fortune off their sports programs, you know, why shouldn't they pay their athletes? But I think the you know, in reality, there's not more than 100 universities in the country that
maybe
are really
not even 100,
maybe not even 100 that are making money off their athletic programs. And what you largely see in American higher ed is what we see at certainly at NKU. And I don't know if this is the same at OCU, but, you know, already the tuition paying students are heavily subsidizing the student athletes. And that subsidy is experienced both in the form of the tuition gets increased to cover the cost of sports, and also academic programs get cut to cover the cost of sports. And that has a negative educational impact on all the students. And I think what we're really going to see here is that, for, you know, this will apply to all schools. So the majority of schools that it's going to apply to, the net effect of it is going to be even further tuition increases, even further decreases in expenditures on academics to give more money to student athletes. Because I think many state legislatures, many of the type of people who serve on boards of regents, many university administrators do believe that high profile athletics is more important than academics. And so if they have to pay more to maintain or improve the quality of their athletic programs, they'll do that. And the money's got to come from somewhere. So I think it's going to have a negative impact on education at most schools, even though I think it's legally the correct ruling. And I think it's also meritorious policy for those, 50 to 100 schools that are actually making a lot of money off athletics.
I agree. And you know, we'll end the show on an agreement in the sense that the problem with this is that as a culture, we highlight sports to the detriment of so many other things. And you know, as the you know, you've had kids too, Ken. As you know, I've got three kiddos, and already it's to watch some of the comparisons about how we have handled this. And again, I'm a sports fan. You know, I love the NBA. Absolutely adore basketball. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that to get to those kind of places that families do, that kids, it's amazing the emphasis that's put. And by the time they get to the university level, the idea that we should be allocating all of these funds for that is terrible. And so the last little bit that I'll just add here is if institutions really want to be about what we talked about in that last case of thinking about the whole student and the whole person, what we really want these kinds of programs, what they ought to be doing is finding ways for students to have lifelong health pursuits, right? So what's something I can do? So maybe I'm going to do running so that I can keep running or swimming for a long time. Because as you and I know, Ken, that's, you know, as you start getting to 40, having those, that's the bigger key here, instead of just wearing people out when they're 19. In most cases, for no really good reason whatsoever. But again, you're right, and you're right about what this probably means for schools down the chain when it comes to their competitiveness. Well, Ken, it's been a lot of fun doing the show with you. I hope you've had fun too.
Oh, yes, I have, Trey. It's been a great show.
So I want to also thank all of our listeners for listening to the Politics Guys. I know for all of the hosts, myself included, it's a lot of fun to do it. It's a labor of love, and it's all due because of really cool, amazing listeners like you guys. Now, of course, one of the ways you can help the show is by subscribing to the Politics Guys on the PodCap app of your choice, and so does sharing episodes word of mouth. Now, the other thing, though, of course, is we need your support, and by becoming a supporter, you get access to other things, including our supporters-only content, and that includes our full-length supporters-only Wednesday show. We also have our supporters Discord channel. So there's all kinds of reasons why you would want to be a supporter. Now, this week, though, not only are we going to have the supporters midweek show,
We're also going to have a free-for-all interview show. And we try to do that to show all the kind of fun things you'd get behind that wall. So this week, you're going to get a bonus midweek show. And we're really excited about that. But if you want our extra one, if you want the one from Ken and myself, once again, you're going to need to become a supporter. So how do you do that? Well, to do that, you can head to our Politics Guys Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys. Or you can learn more and sign in at the Politics Guys website at politicsguys.com/support. So if you want to join me and Ken again, and we're actually going to take on a bunch of Supreme Court cases, including some property right cases coming out of California, please head over to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question or a comment, a correction, or just a thought you'd like to share, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. For supporters, you can always get a hold of us on our Discord channel as well. We're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. I hope you'll join us next time.